Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to the CollectingCast.com podcast with Chris Harris and Edward Lovett.
Hello and welcome to another Collecting Cars podcast. Now, I've been waiting to do this one for quite some time because I'm sitting in southern Germany with someone who I think has made some of the best cars I've ever driven. In fact, his cars probably define my career in cars more than anyone else. He's called Andreas Preuninger, and I don't know what his job title is now. He'll say it in a second. But when I first met him, he handed me a business card and it said Manager-High Performance Cars Porsche. I can't think of a better job title in the world. Is that still your job title? And welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Chris. Happy to be here. Yeah, I remember that situation quite well. It said only manager, and I was not too much okay with that. In the meantime, the business is a little bit different, and it's still high performance cars, but we went through some structural changes, organizational changes in Porsche Motorsport, and so the job titles, despite of me doing mostly the same as I ever did before in the last 20 years, has changed to director GT cars. So this is maybe it doesn't sound as sexy as manager high performance cars, but it's the same at the end of the day.
So you are manager GT cars.
Well,
I like that. Oh no, director GT.
Director,
cars.
It's called director.
Okay. So everyone knows you as the face of the best driving Porsches probably in the history of the company. But I want to understand how you got there. And I also know that how you emerged and what was going on in the company at the time is really interesting, because no one really knew what the potential of the GT line was back then, did they? But so where did your background come from? How do you end up being the person that can define exactly what a GT3 can be? So where did you go to school? When did you leave school? Let's go back there.
Well, it was a long way, definitely, and it was not a road that led in the exact direction that I'm going right now. So it was back and forth. I was a young man. I was studying. I went to school. I always was a little bit uncertain of what to do when I leave university. And my father was working for a big supplier company that made wind tunnels and the scales underneath the wind tunnel. And one fine day, when I was doing my university studies, he asked me if I would like to come along to visit Weissach Development Center. And from Porsche, I was all over it. I said, oh yeah, sure, I'm coming. And that was the first time I stepped into Weissach and saw this huge brain facility with all this 9/11 standing around. I was a freak for 9/11 since I was a small kid.
So what year do you think this was?
It must be 1980, you know, maybe in the 90s, early 90s, I would say, maybe late 80s, something like that. And I started studying at 85, so it must be late 80s. So I think I would make it in 88.
But you critically, 87. You always liked the 9/11, even then.
I liked the 9/11 since I was a young kid. I had this poster, I'm stating this in so many interviews, of this white and blue Carrera RS over my bed, and I was cherishing it, looking at it, and marveling at it every night. I even had my lamps, my lights in my room arranged so that there was a full beam on that car, and this poster was out of a magazine, and it had this pages. It was not a high gloss, super expensive poster. It was something I took out of a magazine. It's a 3 or 4 folded, and pinned it to the wall. And yeah, but still, it's very vivid in my mind. I love the 9/11. I always turned around on them. I love the sound. There was a neighbor that had one, and that took me for a ride. I could ride shotgun one day when I was maybe 12 or something like that, and it was an everlasting impression. Absolutely. So,
how many of us have had that moment where we were taken in all 9/11? Of us? And this is why, if you see a little kid that wants a ride in your car, take them, because it will change their view of cars.
And you know what? I mean, what is so entertaining and so, I mean, astonishing, even today when I'm parking 9/11 in my garage and there's some people coming by with a little kid, it's so often that the little kid, like 3 or 4 years old, stands, looks at the car and says, "Mommy or Daddy, a Porsche." And isn't it incredible? A 3 or 4 year old kid. I mean, we're living in Weissach here, but I experience that exactly the same when I'm visiting friends in Munich or in Cologne or wherever. I mean, little kids can somehow distinguish a 9/11 as something very special and very Porsche. And it was the same when I was young, and it's still around. So isn't it amazing?
So you go to Weissach as a young guy. Your father's making the wind tunnels, and you see the place. You don't start working there straight away.
No.
You go off and what do you go off and do?
I mean, I was driven in the right direction then. From that day when I was visiting the Weissach premises and had a tour through the workshops, the wind tunnel, and saw so many cars, even camouflaged ones. I remember leaning under one and detecting an all-wheel drive system, which wasn't there because it was a 964 Carrera 4 test mule based on a G model. And I asked the guy that was with my father, "Hey, what's this? Is this an all-wheel drive?" And he kept pulling my arm and go away there. And so I was kind of he was smiling.
You
he
do that to me now.
he was not rude, but that was something that still clings to my mind. And when we left Weissach and they got me the calendar and a Porsche model, I knew exactly where I wanted to work from that day on. And all my focusing on career was really centered, I want to go to Weissach. So I finished my university studies and kept bombarding, I would say, Weissach with my CVs. But back then in the days, it was the 964 era. Beginning of the 90s, it was very, very hard to get a job because they had to let people go, so they couldn't hire new people. And also, having sent in at least 10 different CVs, they wouldn't take me. So I had to make a detour in the supplier industry. But I kept trying and trying. And this is my advice for everybody that has a dream. Keep trying. Don't give up. Yeah. Keep trying to reach your goal. It might take some time, but at the end of the day, if you want it hard enough, you'll get it. And in that case as well, you need some luck a little bit, because I got to know Hartmut Christen one day, and he was running a Porsche sales motorsport back then. So the motorsport was divided in two groups. It was the racing. The racing stuff, and it was the selling the car stuff, you know, the kind of selling the cars department that he ran. And the first GT3 was in the planning at that time, and we got quite friends with each other. We talked to each other. It was at a birthday party of some mutual acquaintance, so we didn't know each other, and over a beer found a good conversation. And he said, "Okay, give me your CV again." And that's how it all developed.
What year was that?
That was actually when I started at Porsche. It was the 1st January of 1997. And for the first 2 years, 2.5 years, just to have the foot in the door, I worked for engineering services, because back then Weissach, as a huge R&D center, had more capacity, more brain capacity, more developing capacity than it needed for its old models, because it was only the 911. There was no Boxster back then. And so they sold their engineering, about 30% of the capacity, clandestinely, I would say, to Mercedes, to Opel, even to Harley-Davidson. We did the V-Rod engine. And I was in that department. That was my first Porsche job to sell this project and to be the manager of this project that we had with clients that didn't want to be named. And it was quite an interesting time because I got to know every department in Weissach because I needed all of those people. So that gave me a super cool network. And that's how I got to know Hartmut Christen as well, whom I met later on at the party I was talking about. But I was still already working at Porsche. But that was my way into GT3, into motorsport, because he offered me the job to run the management of the GT3, which was the first 996 Mark I back then. And that was something I always dreamed about.
So the first 996 GT3. Had that already been started when you were working?
Yeah, I was working as an instructor as a side job just for the weekends. I wasn't married back then, and there was so much racing in my head and driving. And before I came to Porsche, I was working for the media, for a newspaper, and for a magazine, Automotor und Sport, which is happens to be the biggest.
So you work for AMS
in Europe? Yeah, for AMS. Yeah, as a freelancer. Parallel to my studies, but I was working full time there because it was so much fun, and I learned so much. All of the driving I learned, the best part was there because we were in Hockenheim every second day. We did these photo runs, and I liked the people. I'm still in contact with many of those, and it was great, really a great time. And that was the first, experience on racetrack and on fast driving. And then I was an instructor at a sport driving school at Porsche. And that was the situation because, I was quite good, I think. So they liked me. I could teach good. I had the language and I had the driving skills. And they gave me the GT3. The first 996 GT3 was a pre-series car. It was in this sausage metallic, I would say, as a rare.
Yeah, that weird color.
Looked weird, looked ugly, but I loved that car to bits. But I was driving it for such a long period of time, and I always kept coming up with things that I didn't like so much. And I said, oh, I want to do this better and that better, and I don't like that, I don't like this. So I had ideas before starting to work on a second gen. What should be done to that car? That was quite funny. And then I met Hartmut Christen, and then I did the second gen of the 996, the Mark II.
So was the second gen your first?
The second gen 996 was my first project. I came to Motorsport as the project manager of the GT3 in, I think it was in October 2000. And that was when the second batch of the 996 Mark I was built. That was one of my first company car.
The second batch of the 996 Gen 1 a bit different to the first batch?
It was an answer to the need of the market, because like so often in the history of these cars, not everybody in Porsche was convinced that we could sell 996 GT3s. And the planning the number planning of the car was quite conservative, and we really, or they, I have to say, because it was not me, they really, Ron Kussmaul and Hartmut Christen, made it to have a good homologation basis for the racetrack. So they didn't care too much about making a business case selling a car, okay? But back in that day, the 996 as a 911 had not the best reputation, because it was liquid cooled, it was looking a little bit strange with this egg-shaped headlights, and it was not as characterful, I would say, as the 993 was, and people missed that. And as soon as the GT3 hit the market, I remember this headline in this big German magazine: "The 911 is back."
Yeah, it fixed.
People
the problem,
said, "Okay, it fixed all the problems on the 996," and through the GT3, even the 996s gained in the reputation, because it was the smaller brother of the GT3, which was such a great car. Obviously.
So the Gen 1.
We had to make a second batch of another 400-500 cars.
Really?
And that was the second batch I was referring to, but it was technically the same as the first one.
So the 996 GT3 has always been a bit of a thorny subject for me, and I've always asked you this question, but I've never asked it to record. I remember collecting the first press car, taking it back to the UK. It was a red one. It was the first time I'd been to Porsche, first time I'd been to Werk Eins, and I just was, you know, I always knew that I loved Porsche, but it cemented the love for me. But I read all the stories about this GT3 beforehand, and I read the reports, and I thought the car was great, but it didn't feel as fast as I thought it was going to feel in a straight line. Didn't feel like it maybe had all the power I thought it did. And the first time we took it to a track, it ran out of brakes very quickly. So I was a bit sort of, okay, is what's going on here? And I remember asking you once, because the 996 GT3 Gen 1 is considered by many people to be the purest GT3. It's the originator. And I never bought into that because I just think it was a really great place to start. But it, as a starting point, it confirmed how much more was possible. And you agreed with me. You were the first. Luckily, you're the bloke that does the cars. You agreed with me.
Still do.
Yeah. But it's a special vehicle for what it stands for. But the second generation 996 GT3 is such a superior car in every way, in terms of the way it drives, the performance. The engine feels like it has 50 horsepower more.
Which is about correct. So don't believe all the numbers written on paper. Yeah, yeah. You're absolutely right. I mean, I stated it before, and I don't want to bash the 996 Mark 1 GT3 because I didn't do it. That's not fair. I love the car, but it was a parts bin exercise, really. Yeah. Yeah? And it was meant to be a parts bin exercise. I mean, it was the aero kit that was available for the 996. It was exclusive wheels that were available for all the other cars, 911 as well. It was the brakes of the had the brakes of the turbo,
and it had, I presume, it was just a turbo engine with
and
the turbos
removed.
It was a
turbo engine saw without the turbochargers and made to rev super high for that time. It was 7,600 or 7,800,
which is high,
which is ridiculous in today's terms, but it was high back then, 20 years ago. But it was a homologation special, so the car lived from taking stuff out. It was old school hot rodding. Make it light and it's quick. Take out the rear seats, and we made this Recaro seats. There's this bucket seat. They're so ugly, but they're still benchmark when it comes to driving position and everything. And we kept exactly that envelope that weight engulfs the driver till today, because it's absolutely perfect. I didn't like the ear shape of the upper part, so we got rid of that. But that was a bespoke GT3 development. The deturbo charging of the turbo and make it more high revving, and some steel synchron rings for the gearbox that from Getruck that we already had, and a little bit of suspension work that Roland Kussmaul did when he was off duty. You know, to be honest, that was the car.
So you start working on the second generation of the 996.
Correct.
And you just mentioned an important name there, Kussmaul. So how is it that you end up with your dream job? How does that feel, first of all?
That was back then. I would pinch myself several times a day, and came down to motorsport, and Hartmut Christen handed me the key for a second batch silver GT3 to drive with, and it was brand new. I couldn't believe it. I could not believe it. It was so good. At my office, I had two or three people working with me, and I had all the freedom to invent, to be creative, to make the GT3, bring the GT3 to the next level. And that was not a pressure, that was a joy, because I knew already, because I've driven the car so much on track and in the sport driving school, what to do. But funnily, the first thing I did, you will laugh maybe, is addressing the hubcaps of the wheel, because I always hated on the first gen GT3 that there was no GT3 sign on those. And I said, what? No, why? This is something everybody gets when he has a Carrera. So I wanted that to be special. And then, so that was the first thing I can remember exactly. It was a tooling cost of 6,000 euros. And for me, as a total beginner, I called Hartmut Christen as a Hartmut, or Mr. Christen back then. I have this idea with this. It might sound strange to you, but it was always nagging me. We need bespoke wheel hubcaps. And he said, okay, what's the problem? Do it. Yeah. And I felt like, what? So just so I can do it, can order this and get it going. And that was the first day, you know. And then came more and more and more. I've been to the design studio, said we need bespoke wheels. I want a different suspension. We need the engine to be a lot more, let's say, torquey, and maybe we find some RPMs, and I addressed the whole car. So we're going from the aerodynamics to brakes, and everything was bespoke after that. So it was a much bigger project, the second gen.
The first gen was more of a Skunk Works homologation exercise.
Exactly.
Who at Porsche decided to make the GT3 a model? Because then it needed funding properly. Who made that decision? Was that made at board level? It must have been, wasn't it?
It's always board level when you make a new car. So the suggestion comes from the team mostly, or from marketing or sales as well. Not so much in our case. Was never that way, but we needed for racing. We needed a car that was more capable, and we needed something on the basis of the 996. And we couldn't use the 996 Carrera basis in a way that we really thought it would be competitive. And Roland Kussmaul, back then responsible for street cars and for the race cars, said, "Okay, we need a homologation special of a 996, and we make a street version of it because we had to sell it a couple hundred times to make it a legal homologation car."
Yeah.
And that was the task. And it was mainly coming from Roland Kussmaul and Hartmut Christen. These two made a decision to approach the board with a suggestion to make a car like that to be able to compete in racing.
Right, we're going to take a quick break there. So go and have a biscuit. It's an early break, and I'm telling you this because we're going to have lunch. We're having lunch. This is a relaxed way of recording. So go and have a comfort break. Go and have a chocolate bourbon and a cup of tea. We'll be back in a minute.
If you have a rare, sporting or iconic vehicle to sell, then contact the Collecting Cars consignment team today and sell with the market leader. And if you're a watch enthusiast, then don't forget to check out the auctions on watchcollecting.com.
And we're back. We're sitting down. Okay. Welcome back to this Collecting Cars podcast with Andreas Preuninger. We've had a very nice pasta lunch with a bit of chili in it. I like a bit of heat. We all agree. You like a bit of chili in your food?
I love a lot of chili.
Exactly. And we were just discussing 996 Gen 1 against 996 Gen 2. I also want to ask you about this this Kussmaul name, because when you first started working there, were you aware of what a legend he was and what he'd done? Because his history with the 911 is quite extraordinary, isn't it? And to have him working with you must have felt so secure, because he was surely the perfect person to say, is this right, is this wrong?
Sure. For me, Roland Kussmaul was a legend before I started working at Porsche. I mean, his run in the Pirelli Paris-Dakar, being piloting the service truck and entering, I think, in a very high up position. I think we won the class of the trucks just by companioning the 959 back then. He was a legend in the company. It was always when I was working for the first 3 years in the normal development, not in motorsport. Ron Kussmaul, you saw him sometimes sitting in a car coming by. He always looked friendly, and I was always like bowing my head a little bit because I had heard so much things about him. And I was really very interested in getting to know him. But there was not so much business for me down there at the racing department. That came later when I joined Hartmut Christen, and Roland was one of the first guys I met. And after a couple of hours with him, he offered me to address him on the first name. And it was something, it was really a praise for me, and I felt so honored and flattered. And I think he liked me because we did a lot of talking, and I really can say most of the stuff I learned about cars, about setting up a car, about the car as a whole, as a system, as a system that is has to work in synchronicity of all the parts moving and how a car gets the right feeling. That's all I learned from him, because we had this routine starting from the first days when I started on motorsport. That I went into his office, which actually is my office today, so it's the same room, which is great. so it's a holy walls, and it was 7 o'clock, and we were just sitting there, planning the day or just discussing about the car we had with us overnight, and discussing what it did and what it needed, and how we're gonna achieve this, and how we're gonna achieve that, and how we're gonna achieve it the most effective way, and this is what I was. Definitely, what was a his one of his greatest virtues, I would say, or what if his best experience of how to do things correctly at the first trial.
Because what's critical here is that clearly he, Kusmal had this way of doing things, was that a lot of the work was driving home, wasn't it? He would do all the setup and everything else would just be the drive home, which is so logical because that's the road you know the best.
Exactly.
That's when your head is clear. Right. Why go to Papenburg and hire a test track? It's all foreign. Just do it on your drive home.
Yeah, we did that as well. Going to Papenburg, doing this high velocity or this high speed lane changes, you need some safety zones around you. You can't do it on the street.
Yeah.
But he always said the car has to really, really perform out there, right next to our main gate. So on my way home, on these beautiful tracks or streets here in the northern, at the northern rim of the Black Forest. And there's lots of good streets. So you know these streets. I showed you some of them. And that's why we set up the car, because he was a firm believer, and I still think that's the right way to look at it, that the car should work on any given normal street as well. So you can't make it too tautly sprung. You need the traction, you need the behavior on a wet surface that is user friendly. And he all took that into the equation of making a fast car, and he sacrificed some of the lap time stuff for that, for this sporty daily usability.
So quite often in those situations when you have someone who has his experience, this incredible experience, and someone young comes in to work or to run a project, there can be a bit of resentment. It's quite, having met Roland, he doesn't strike me as that guy. He would have just wanted to help you and teach you.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, with Roland, you needed to earn his respect. So there were people that he didn't think too highly of, and they never got a car.
Yeah.
It's like that. I mean, he said, no, why does he have to drive the car? There's no benefit for the company for that, because he can't drive anyway and he can't judge the car. And so it's of no use for me. It's just dangerous to lose the car. It gets scratched. But I'm the same, absolutely honest. And Roland was a very, very nice guy. And I always had the feeling he wanted to, to teach me the stuff he knew, and I was not the only one. He had other guys around as well, but we had a very special relationship from day one, and we always laughed a lot because Roland Kusma is like a little kid, and like me, we always were stealing stuff from each other. I took three mechanics and we manhandled his motorcycle to a completely different spot, and one time we built in a heated seat in the bucket of his car and hot wired it to the to the ignition, and I can tell you and it was an aftermarket mat that we put underneath the cushions, and it got so hot you could not sit in that. And this went back and forth all the time. When Roland and me was around, there was always something going on. And it's still that way when he's visiting Weissach. Last time he came with his 964 RS, we sneaked out and took the seat out, or the seat cushions out, and packed in like five or six thick Polish newspapers, all the magazines. I couldn't read them anyway, so I don't need those. And put them underneath your seat and put the cushion bag on. And you didn't notice it. And normally, I mean, a height change in the seat is so drastically noticeable. I mean, when you drive a car with your bum. Yeah? And I was expecting him to immediately notice. And I watched him get into the car. He was sliding around a bit, but then he drove off. and I thought, oh my goodness, he's getting old.
No, he's a legend. So you've gone, I think one of the big shifts for the GT3 product was you the 996 GT3 Gen 2 comes out, and it's clear this brand, there's almost a separate brand within Porsche. You have 911, and then people are using the phrase GT3 as a separate thing to a 911. This was quite important.
It's a brand of its own.
03, 04. Yeah. But at that point, you wouldn't have known that. It was growing, wasn't it?
Not quite, because if you look at it closely, the GT3 was just an internal code name for the first 996 Mark I project, because it was the homologation car for the GT3 race class back then. And they were searching for a name, but couldn't come up with something very clever, which was often the case in our nomination of cars, to be honest. When I first heard Carrera GT, I said, oh my God, what a stupid name. When I first heard Macan, I said, no way. But at the end of the day, after a couple of years, they work. So I was wrong. But no, and we just said, oh, why not name it just GT3? Well, and now if you ask somebody out on the street, what's GT3, everybody will say it's a Porsche model and it's not a race class. So we turned the thing around and created an own brand, this GT3 or GTX, as we call it, brand, because it's GT2 as well. And the RS models, they became a very powerful brand in the industry at the moment.
So you've got this, the GT3 996 Gen 2 is fixed. It has a more powerful engine. It has brakes that work. It's got the steel synchro rings. It's working. And then you, I remember you telling me, you hark back to this picture of the Harmler guy, 73 RS, and you think, we need to make an RS.
That was another homologation necessity, I would say, because the race car, the RS, it was back then named, or the designation was the GT3 RS, was the race car. Only when we stole the RS moniker, it's gotten the RSR. That was my suggestion. Just put another R in it, then I can have the RS. So we noticed that there were some parts in the suspension that were responsible for a big disadvantage on the track, because the tires wore, the stints you can drive with the tire were shorter than on the competition, and that was had something to do with the wheel carriers and the pivot points and everything. So when the wheel was moving in the wheel well, the camber, the dynamic camber change was just too big. And so we really needed a homologated part for the race car to address this flaw. And so we made a new wheel carrier with the point that was the wishbone was mounted a little bit deeper then. So that means when the car, a lowered car was standing, if you stand in front of the lowered car, the lower wishbone was exactly parallel to the surface.
Yeah.
And that means when the suspension is compressed, you have an even tire wear, and you have an even the dynamic camber change is a lot more static, I would say. And that was very important for keeping the tires over longer stints, and that worked. And so we needed to homologate these parts. And Roland Kusma said, okay, let's do 200 GT3 Mark IIs and just put that stuff in, make them a homologation series, but they didn't plan on doing anything else to the car, just introduce this, some changes that we needed for the race car. And I said, no, stop, we can't do that, because this is, why not do something out of that is a lot better for the brand, for the core of the brand, for the customer, and which is a little bit supporting our own heritage and history. And then this picture of this, this poster of above my bed came into my mind and said, let's make a homage to the Carrera RS 2.7 and do something else in the car, make RAM air, address some minor stuff on the car to make it lighter, to make it better, maybe even give it a little bit more power. Back then we didn't realize that it would be a huge homologation process to do that, so we, on paper, we didn't. In reality, we did. Later, maybe we can talk about that later. And so the 996 RS project came along. And I suggested this to Hartmut Christ, and let me do a homologation special that is really noticeably different from the GT3 and name it RS. And he said, no, we can't name it RS. That's a race car. And I said, okay, let's rename the race car. And that was how that began.
And so you, did you just, for the optics, because to relaunch the RS brand that quietly, given how big that car was in the history of the company, was huge. And it seemed like it was done in quite a relaxed fashion. Did you just go, this looks all right, let's just do that? Or did it have to go right to the top and everyone wanted their
input? Absolutely. You have to always go to the top, because you need funds for the development, you need funds for the tooling, you need to get the salespeople behind you, the markets that have to sell the car. As a matter of fact, so you first have to approach the markets and propose the car and say, hey, what do you think?
What did they say?
Well, it was a history repeating itself, I would say. It was they were not so keen on the car, because they said, oh, this car looks kind of pornographic.
Yeah.
And because it was white with this red Carrera RS or GT3 RS in that case, lettering, and it was with carbon stuff and low and... They didn't get the idea so much, like 20 years before as well, on the RS27. And we said, no, I think this is definitely something we should do. And it has a clutch that is a lightweight clutch and a lightweight flywheel. And how does it operate? Is it? They were unsure about it. They gave us a quota, how many they could sell. And we had to base this business case upon that quota to make a sane proposal to Mr. Wiedeking, because Wiedeking didn't get out of bed without making money. So you couldn't approach him and said, okay, we can exchange some money here. Yeah, so give him, so maybe it'll
you give me the money, I'll give you the same back.
So it had to make a profit. And that was kind of difficult with only 195 cars. That was the first estimation of all the world.
Was it 195
markets.
Cars?
195 cars.
How many did you make in the end?
I was around 700, and we ran out of tooling. Yeah, that was the way. I mean, it's a learning curve. I don't want to bash the colleagues of marketing and sales here. I mean, they just were not used to cars like that. So it was the first time. And in a big company, to convince somebody about a first-time thing, GT4 was similar, or 911R, you always need a little bit more talking and explaining. Yeah. Not today anymore. So now everybody got it.
Yeah,
and it's really a good.
Did
move,
you think for a minute you'd make nearly 800 of the GT3 RS?
I was sure of that.
Were you?
I think we could have sold a lot more. The car was such a hoot to drive. It was so responsive, so nimble, so light, and we had competition back then. The M3 CSL just came out and battered the times or shattered the times of the Nürburgring.
Yeah,
it had cup tires and it looked cool. It sounded like an animal. I loved the car. And we had to be a lot quicker than this, which we were.
Yeah.
But it was not it was not like baking cakes. It was hard work. It was hard competition out of Munich.
So when you get to the 997 project, the brand is now established. GT3 is a brand, and most critically, everyone expects there to be a 997 GT3. We're waiting for the launch of the car. The 997 Carrera is launched, and it's not a question of will there be a GT3. It's when will it come?
Yeah.
It's a critical change. Was that then? Would that feel more grown up, that project? At that point, you must have more people. The department must be bigger. The expectation of the car is greater. You might have to sell more. Did it feel like you had a more grown up job?
Absolutely. I mean, the 996 Mark II and the RS, they were the igniting spark of this new GT hype, I always would say. Oh, the people loved the car. And there was no doubt on the 997 that we had to do a GT3 version. And yes, the 997 body was a bit more grown up. It was one of the nicest 911, if you ask me, we ever did, because it had these hips and then it had exactly the right size in my opinion. And it was a fun project to make the 997. We had so much freedom back then. And just to give you an example, the Alcantara interior, it comes because I always had Lancia Delta Integrales when I was young. I adored this car, and I had two of those or three, and I still love it. And this had this Alcantara interior, which I always loved. And I thought, hey, why not doing something like this? And on a 996 RS, we started with a steering wheel and everything you touch and the gear lever. And I wanted the Alcantara interior, a complete one. And we did it. We didn't go to the board. We didn't go to the studio. We just did it, and booms, the car was ready. Everybody loved it. I mean, this is the process today. The decision process is so much more complicated. But this was just the interior, which is a minor point. No, it was the car had a great platform. It had a wider track. It was a little bit bigger. We could fit back bigger wheels, and we were continuing of making a lot more changes over the Carrera to have the GT3. So the differentiation between the Carrera and the GT3 or 997 went to the next level. If you compare it even to the 996 Mark II, so we addressed so many things on the car. We did the engine. We did the gearbox, and the aero was bespoke because we managed to convince our colleagues from the exclusive department that they couldn't use this aero kit for any normal Carrera, because we needed it for ourselves to make the GT3 its own model
and the
that can't be copied. And they were not so happy about it.
They're not.
But it made our argumentation made sense. Yeah.
What about the center? The center exit exhaust was so important for me. I'm
absolutely
a geek, because when I remember turning up to the launch. In fact, that was the first time I met you. Was somewhere in Italy,
right,
for the launch of the 997 GT3, I think Gen 1,
yeah,
and seeing the two exhausts out the middle and thinking, That looks completely different to a Carrera. Just as a signature, that is a different statement.
Yeah,
and it stayed forever.
The funny thing is, I mean, it really is the truth. On the launch of the 996 Mark II, I was sitting with Hartmut Christen and Hans-Georg Breuer, who was head of the powertrain department at Motorsport back then and responsible, therefore, for the GT3 engine. And we discussed about the 997 GT3 launching the 996 Mark II. And we always said, we need a different exhaust. We need a different exhaust note. We want to make it lighter. We want to make it tighter and more race-like. And Hans-Georg Breuer took really a napkin, a paper napkin and a pen. And then we make the first sketches of this central exhaust with a flapper, with operated flappers and headers. And that was where the idea was born. And I remember Hartmut saying, a complete new exhaust. That's so much money, so much tooling. And I said, but maybe we should do it. The car would sound differently, because back then on a 996, the GT3 mainly lived from its intake noise.
Yes.
Yeah. And because the exhaust was the same then on a standard Carrera. And we really had very, very hard, very good feelings about it. The GT3 deserves its own characteristical noise. And we wanted to lower the back pressure as well. So it was not only noise. We want to make it lighter. We want to make it more powerful. We were always thinking one step ahead and... trying to make the car continuous improving.
When you're on a project like 997, you already knew then how different the RS was going to be from the normal car. Whereas the 996, it was just luck. You had to make you had to homologate a new part, so you make an RS.
Yeah, but the RS, the 996 RS, I have to correct you there. There were so many bespoke parts on that thing.
There were, but yeah. when you did the first 996, you had no idea there was going to be an RS.
No.
Whereas with the 997, you knew there was going to
Absolutely,
be an RS.
Because and actually, such a huge success.
And you had, of course, then you had, it was the first car that had a different power output. It had different gear ratios.
Yep.
It was a different car, wasn't it? In that respect, you offered the customer something over and above a GT3.
I mean, the 997 Gen 1 RS, I really have to think back, because I did like 18 cars now, and this was my third or fourth. I mean, the main differentiation on the first Gen 997 was the white body.
Yeah.
The white, it was the first RS that featured the white body of the turbo.
Yeah.
And that was quite a change. The engine was mainly unchanged.
Yeah.
It was a single mass flywheel maybe, but... there were some lightweight parts, but the main difference...
The gearing was different, though. It had shorter ratio, didn't it?
The gearing was the same, no.
Was it? Okay, I'm going to have to go back and check that.
On the second generation, we made 20 horsepower more, so we had another different intake system.
I'm being out-geeked.
The differentiation between GT3 and RS started to grow as well from 997 on. But the first 997 was mainly the body, the color, different spoiler, more aero. But done in a rather conventional way and some lightweight parts.
Yeah. So around that time, you're living in the area, you live in Flacht, or were you living in this part of the world? You're living in Stuttgart. And there's another side to you. Now, everyone hears you talk about cars. You love motorcycles. You love enduro bikes. There's other stuff that you love doing. And he'll blush here. He's really good on an enduro bike. Like, he does proper wheelies and stuff like that. So... do you find that stuff helps you take your brain away from the cars, or has motorcycling always been in your life, hasn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I was growing up in the 80s, and the first milestone in a boy's life when he was turning 15 and could ride a moped, like a small motorcycle. And at 16, you could have an 80cc bike that is running 80 kilometers per hour. That was like light speed. It was warp 5 or warp 10 back then. And so all our lives centered around having a motorcycle. So I was, and we needed it to go to school or to wherever. So it was just normal in my youth that the normal cycle, the motorcycle or the scooter, whatever they had, was a main part of your life. And when you turned 18, you needed a bigger bike. And so I was always into biking. I'm not biking too much today. I've got several KTMs, which I love to use, but it's unfortunately very illegal here in Germany. So
what's the free? But you've got the electric one, the free ride. How cool is that?
I mean, this is something people comment often. Oh, you have an electric bike, you? And I say, yeah, well, because it's stealth.
Yeah.
Nobody hears me when I'm doing illegal stuff out there in the woods. And I'm running into people collecting mushrooms and they don't even notice me. When they turn their back on me, I'm just like 10 meters away. I turn around and off I am without any people yelling at me. Yeah, I mean, this electric bike is really very, very cool, and you don't have to warm it up. And I have to confess, I have a 300 two-stroke KTM as well, which I love a lot more. But it makes a racket, and it's you always have this bad conscience when you drive around with that thing illegally. So I only use it on track.
Do you agree with me that the electric enduro bike is the most impressive deployment of electricity in a vehicle that you've come across? It feels the most natural use of it. It feels like it was meant for it, which is different to a car. The car always feels like it's compromised when it's electric, but the electric enduro bike is an amazing thing, isn't it?
It's amazing, and I mean, you need a power pack that supports at least 2 hours of enduro driving, which mine does easily. After that, you're done anyway, and you're exhausted. So
yeah,
it doesn't matter. And I only use that thing for a short hop when I'm coming home on a after a hard day's work, and I see it standing in the garage. I just have all my clothes in the garage, and so I sneak out. Nobody heard me coming, so nobody's waiting for me, and then just take it for a spin for an hour. And then
I can remember being in America filming The Outer Freedom, and you sending me a note going, oh, you're riding one of these.
Oh,
that's such a shame that company didn't work, because that product was incredible. That really was special.
I visited the company. It was up in San Francisco when I was in Monterey during Rennsport or something like that, because I was so interested in buying one. And I met the owner, and he showed me the production line, and we had like a two-hour ride on that thing out in the desert. It was so cool. I would have bought it straight on if they have been available here in Germany. And I'm really sad that I didn't make it. But on the other hand, I mean, this is a product for really not everybody. And there was just, the market was too small for a sophisticated enduro bike like that. But it's a pity. I would still love to have one, to be honest.
There's an enduro biking theme with all of you Porsche motorsport people, isn't there? Because quietly, Kusmal likes riding an enduro bike as well.
We all ride.
You all go off and ride, don't you?
We all ride. Yeah, definitely. It's not the only thing I do. I like to drive my classic car from time to time as well. I love my boat. I love to be out in the water to get away from it all. Big engine, but everything around me is controllable. So I like to be with my family. Have a little bit of quality time, and but I need a rumble of a big V8 behind me, and this is really what is catalyzing what is downwinding me best, being out in the water.
And another secret, which he won't thank me for, he's really good at making and flying radio controlled helicopters. He showed me one of these things years ago. It's so complicated. If I tried to fly, I'd just fly it straight into a house. Is it the challenge of the coordination that you like, or is it building the things?
I think it's not building the things too much. I like complicated things where I have to get my head around, which at first seemed to be so complicated and so hard to learn, and this is challenging me. And I like aviation. I think in my next life I'd be a pilot, definitely, because this is one of my dreams. With this helicopters, I started that because my son Philip was into that, and it was something for father and boy to do. And I didn't do it too much in the last couple of years. So I'd rather put on my VR goggles and fly a Spitfire or a Mustang above the channel. Which is really super addictive, If you've got the right equipment, a super, super fast computer with a super big graphic card, the best goggles. I mean, what technology offers us today is mind boggling, definitely. So, I feel more like flying when I'm sitting in my chair in front of my PC than when I'm doing this helicopter thing.
Amazing. I think, I come back to the bike thing. It's quite important to me. When I found out that you all liked going off on enduro bikes, because there is a bit of a two wheels versus four wheels argument that goes on around the world. Yeah. And everyone that I know that makes, I think, the best cars, the most emotional cars.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Understands what motorcycles mean and what a motorcycle makes you feel. I think it's quite important. And the switch side is some of the cars that I've not found quite as impressive. If you speak to some of those teams, they don't seem to get motorcycles. It's a strange thing to observe.
Right.
But I think it's really important. If you can't, because I can remember talking to Kusman, him saying, you know, we go off and ride bikes in the spare time. That's what we do.
Yeah.
And actually, and I love the idea of him talking about the, he got some special Michelin sticky tires for his old VFR or something. And he was winding up all the sports bike riders because he had more grip.
It was a Dominator.
Was it a Dominator?
It's a Honda Dominator out of the, I think it's, mid-80s bike or something like that. He still loves it.
I like the fact that the you can't make a car, you can't make a series of cars as emotional as the GT3 unless you allow yourself to be influenced by the environment around you. And that means everything.
You need inspiration. And I get all the inspiration mostly from things that have a motor. And I love things with a motor. And it's good when the motor is too big for the thing, you know, because then it never gets boring. So I always tend to like overpowered stuff. If it's a boat, a plane, a bike, yeah, something that you have to control as the human being, something that can bite at you if you do it wrong. This is the challenge to master the machine, and this is the rewarding thing if you make it. It shouldn't be boring. It should be challenging, and challenge that you conquer is equals fun for me. Being out in the nature on a bike as well. I'm a nature guy, but I always want some technology with me.
I'm a nature guy, but I always want to, that's a quotation, but I wasn't challenged with me. How did you handle the fact that because your vehicles were so well loved by the media and by the consumers, you became, you know, a kind of personality within Porsche. Your name was associated with the products. You got drawn into the conversation. Then there's the awful forum thing and all that other stuff. Were you surprised that that happened, or was it not a surprise? I know we've spoken about it at length. It's a difficult place to have your work discussed in an open forum, because you want to go in there and intervene, but of course we know you can't intervene. What did that make you think, I don't want to do this anymore, or did you manage to just park it to one side?
I mean, I didn't think that I would be recognized at airports and people coming over to me and wanting a selfie, or getting so many mails of thank you for the car and everything. So people seem to like what I'm doing, at least the people that are buying, that are into Porsche. And I'm not a guy that likes to be in the center of attention, to be honest. So that came with the job, and it's part of the job, and I accept it. And mostly the reactions of people to me and my product are so positive that it's rewarding. Okay, yes. I have that. There's critics as well, and if I'm reading forums, I run my fingers to my hair and say, wow, I want to dig into the keyboard and
tell this guy how it is.
And it's really hard. So I stopped. Yep. I really stopped going into forums, because it sometimes aggravates me too much. And I cannot let myself go and discuss stuff there. That's why I always proposed or suggested to make within Porsche maybe a own forum that is hosted by us, that we can like address stuff or comment to rumors that are completely wrong. And but it's a complicated process, but we're still working on that, because the people out there deserve to know what's going on, and they deserve to be corrected when there's some rumors going around that is bad for the product, bad for the customer, bad for me or whoever. We like the truth. We're very transparent, we're very honest always, and I think that's the way to do it. And the popularity of my person, if you can call it popularity, if you look at Insta or something like that, is flattering. I like it in a way. Some people look at me, oh wow, this is Breuninger, and he has a little bit of leverage out there, but I don't care too much. I'm a private person, so I don't feast on that. But sometimes it gives you the opportunities to meet interesting people. This is what I like most about that I'm coming in contact with people that are really have interesting stories behind them, if this car stories or life related somehow, and that's what I really appreciate, to be in this position, to get to know people, cultures, and make friends.
The number of people who are really, really big names, either in racing or in outside of the world of cars, that have said to me, I can't get a GT3. I can't get on the list. Can you speak to Breuninger and see if he'll get me one? And I'm not talking minor celebrities. I'm talking really, really big names. You forget that everyone wants a GT3 and not everyone can get one. It's incredible.
This might be right. Yeah. I mean, we're really trying to raise production numbers with every model that we pull out, and we do. But it's under proportional to the need from the markets, which is so we always have the same situation on a different level. Then, even with the 911R, we thought, okay, with almost 1,000 cars, we don't run into the same problem as with the RS 4-liter, where we only had 600. And but we were so wrong, you know. And even with the Speedster with 2,000, so we always double. It was still not enough. And people, and this is, I'm feeling very sorry for this. Are disappointed then, but I have to say it's not true that Mr. Breuninger can call Mr. Breuninger and then you get a GT3, because this is really something our markets do, and markets are separate entities. They're connected to us, but they have the power of decision through their dealerships whom to give a car. We can only ask to consider to give a customer that is very close to us the chance to drive to drive a car, GT3 or whatever, so we don't have the power to influence all that. This is just a fairy tale.
How did you deal with the emergence of the popularity of the normally aspirated cars, but also the fact that you had a heritage in turbocharged cars as well? Because when you used to speak about the normally aspirated, the atmospherical cars, as you would always say, It was about passion. It was about intake noise. But also in the 997 era, you had this slightly strange car, the 997 GT2, which actually looking back, I'm more and more fond of that car. I think it's a spectacular car. And the crazy, looking back, GT2 RS, 600 horsepower, manual gearbox 911. I mean, it was an insane motor vehicle, but these cars are almost forgotten in your history of cars. How do you feel about them?
Well, I never forgot those. I mean, the 997 GT2 RS was a project that was really a skunk work project. So we wanted to make an RS version of a GT2, because I think the 997 GT2 was a little bit tame. I didn't do the project, by the way. That was a colleague of mine, Alan Lewin, an Englishman. He's retired by now, and he did the 997 GT2 before he retired. And then I took over and said, okay, let's make a GT2 RS out of it. And it was called the Beast internally, because we took out weight. It's true. We took out weight. It was a silver car. We took out weight. We made the first carbon fiber fenders, and they looked ugly. They had joints like you could put your hand in it, but the car was lighter still. It was around 1340 kilo or even less on that test mule, and we had like 580 horsepower on that thing. It was so ridiculously fast back then. It wouldn't feel as fast today, but that was just the pinnacle of it all. It was almost a suicide machine, I called it. It was the beast. We referred it to the beast. Everybody wanted to drive it, and so this project developed. It was when we were testing, I think, the GT3 second gen. In Portugal, in Estoril, we were sitting at an Italian place with all the mechanics, and this idea came up with Carsten Schepstadt back then, who oversaw the driving dynamic side, and some engineers and some mechanics. It was really something the team invented, and we said, okay, come, let's make a prototype, and that's how the Beast came along. And then we proposed the Beast to the board and said, okay, let's do it right, make an RS out of that, and maybe do it as a special run, as a limited edition. And so the GT2 RS was born.
Were they easy to sell as well? Did they all sell straight away?
Absolutely, buff. Yeah. Not quite as fast as a GT3 RS 4-liter. We had, I think, 500. It was 500 GT2 RSs, and they sold. Definitely, it was a hugely expensive car back in the days, but they sold. But there wasn't that big of an overhang of need and want. So it was relatively correctly numbered.
Around that time is when I was spending a bit of time with you, and you had this idea with the GOs. GOs, by the way, is German for press office. Hence the reason why, if you didn't know, when you see a press car, it has S number plate GO. That means it's from the press department. I'm saying that because I'm not always surprised at the number of people that don't know that. The idea of racing a 997 GT3 Gen 2 3.8 at the Nürburgring 24 hours. We've never really discussed that in public. So Andreas provided a test car, and it was prepared to go racing. We did two VLN races to test the car, and then went straight into a 24-hour race. The car drove there to the circuit, came 13th overall, and drove back again. It still feels like we didn't actually do it, because I can't quite believe how straightforward it was. Nothing went wrong. Everything we did, the car didn't miss a beat. The car now sits in the museum. Why did you do that? Because looking back, if it had gone wrong, it would have been a shit fight.
Sometimes it's so much fun to carry a risk. Now we were so happy about how the car performed. We thought, hey, this car is so quick, it would even be competitive in a professional motor race like the 24 hours. And this car had a huge advantage. It can go there on the Autobahn, put on a set of slick tires and do the race. That was the idea that we had back then with the press people, said maybe we can do some great media value out of this, because the car can do it and the car should be competitive. And Wolfgang Dürheimer, who was the CEO or the board member of engineering back then, we could ignite him to that idea, and he gave us the funds to do it, to do this several VLN races up front and prepare the car for the race. Sure, we had to use different tires, we had to use different brake pads, we even used a little bit tighter, stiffer springs, but that was mainly...
Was that really the only difference to that car?
That was the only difference, and the car was not specially prepared because we didn't have so much funds. It was a pre-series car I had standing in the garage, the white one. Nobody wanted it, and I said, okay, let's take that one, because then we don't have to spend money. It was a pre-series engine, and there was it had almost 0 kilometers, so it was well qualified for the job, and... the modifications we did to the car were mainly to meet the regulations of the VLN race. And I have to say, we were very lucky. We had a great car, but we had a great team of drivers. I mean, you were in the car, and it was Patrick Simon. It was
Roland Asch.
Roland Asch, the former DTM.
He was a character. Was a character.
Yeah. And who was the fourth?
Horst.
Yeah.
I remember having there was a technical meeting, and I used to have to sit in these technical meetings, and my German is okay, but it's not good enough when it comes to spring rates and other stuff like that. And at the end of the meeting, Roland Asch had been talking, and at the end I sat down looking fairly bewildered, and one of the engineers or the chiefs came over and said, "You okay?" I went, "I could understand what everyone was saying, but," I said, "when Roland talks, I just cannot understand a word."
He's Swabian.
Yeah, and this German disguise said, "Don't worry, neither can we." Schwabisch. I've never heard that Schwabisch dialect.
But he's such a cool guy.
I remember mega.
When he was in the morning, so it was maybe in the 18th hour or 17th hour, just after it broke daylight. He was on the radio, and he was speeding down Döttinger Strait, and he was singing. He said, "Hey Andy, this is so good." What means this is so great to be here. He thanked me for being in the race, and it was such a strange moment. The sun was going up, and he was singing in the car. overtaking some cup cars because we were faster on the straight line.
Yeah, that was the bit. That was the bit we didn't talk about at the time. It's a shame that it was just before the video era, because it would have been such an amazing project to video. It was a great shame.
Yeah, we didn't do. We should have done a lot more marketing, because half the world, only some people know that. In the same race was the first hybrid GT3 Cup.
Yeah.
So everybody's concentrating on that car, because in the crucial stage of the race, I think it was leading.
Then it broke.
Over, and then it broke because of a valve spring or something like that, something stupid. And yeah.
But I always remember being in the, I think it was a VLN race, when we were testing during the VLN race. And I remember someone coming on the radio and saying, can you back off on the straight? Because the GT3 RS is so fast in a straight line, we're getting complaints because it's much faster than the cup cars. They're going to give us a speed restriction.
I was in the paddocks, and Olaf Mantai stormed over to our booth and said, oh, make this street car slower, because if he overtakes the cup car, we have to do another lap and we don't have enough gas. Yeah? And that car was leading. And he was fuming. Yeah? And so we had to back off a little. But
it worked out finally.
It
was a special project. And I think it just helped build this legend that actually these are cars that have all the engineering of a race car, but they're usable on the road. So you've gone through 3.8 RS. Then there's this incredible vehicle called the 4-litre RS, which I understand why people think they're so special. I was lucky enough to own one. Thank you. But I
shouldn't have sold it.
I know I shouldn't have. Well, there's lots of things I shouldn't have sold, Andres, including houses. I had a 993 GT2, man. I shouldn't have sold that. That'd be worth £1 million now. But there's something about that car that if I asked people that study your career closely, they'll say, what was his high point? Mm. They will say that car is your high point. I don't necessarily agree. I think it was a spectacular car. But why do people, is it because it's the last of the Metzger engine cars? Is there so much emotion bound up in that? Why do people go so crazy for the 4.0 RS?
That's a good question. No doubt it is a very special car. I think it looks very special because it looks completely different than what everybody expected. I wanted to have it white wheels. It's totally against the stream. But if you want to come end up at the source, you have to swim against the stream.
Yeah.
And it is, I loved it a lot. I loved the project. And to have this 4-liter last edition Metzger that we used in the race car as well, because the R engine had 4 liters. And I kept nagging Hans-Georg Breuer, the boss of Powertrain, hey, can't we use this engine as a street engine? And, oh, no, it doesn't burn as good. The emission side, I don't know. And I said, oh, come on, let's try it. We have to make something. That would be a great swan song for the 997. And we were already into that mode of knowing that special projects will add up to our heritage and are received quite well to the from the
That's
customer
interesting.
Base.
So at that point you were aware of the fact that everything you touched turned to gold, really.
Not quite. I didn't want to make a sellout of a 997. I really was very, very interested in having this 4-liter engine in a road car, because there was so much potential. We built up a prototype engine and put it in my one of my cars, which was a normal small-bodied GT3 997, and it was such a hoot to drive. That thing had so much torque and it was so responsive.
Is this the car that
and
you
and I wanted to give the
going.
Customer dead engine out
Is this the blue car with the short gearing?
Yeah.
Does that still exist?
Yeah.
You let me drive that very briefly once.
I drive it myself. I mean,
every person that thinks they know and have owned every GT3 RS, there's some stuff they've got in their garage, as you can imagine, that's a bit special. Mm. And one of them is an aqua blue GT3 narrow body 997 Gen 2, and its engine and gearbox are not normal, are they?
So it's the RS 4-liter engine, the first of its kind. And that car was insanely fast on the Autobahn because it's coefficient
narrow.
Drag, narrow body, and it has this 500 horsepower engine, and it was just ripping. It was like 330 or something like that.
What would that be worth on the open market? If you put that to an auction, that particular car, this would be a million euros, wouldn't it?
There's so many people out there with unlimited funds, so it would sell, but I don't think we could part with it. So some stuff has to stay in our own vault.
But we've seen some pictures of that vault. So we then move from the 4-liter, the end of the Metzger, and suddenly you're in a very difficult position, aren't you? Because you, for the first time probably ever, you have to try and sell, reinvent and sell the new concept of a GT3. So you've got, you no longer have a Metzger engine. You've got to start, you've got to have a new sort of motorsport engine. You make the decision to go with no manual gearbox. And then you have to sell that thing to people like me and to the public. And strangely, it's much harder to sell it to idiots like me, the media, because we're the ones going, why hasn't it got a manual? But you must know deep down that everyone you make, you're still going to sell, because that's what's happened with GT3. But that period of time was fascinating for me. I'd sit in so many interviews with you and go, so is there going to be a manual? And you'd go, no. Don't ask me the same fucking question again.
Yeah, that's the shut up and drive era. Yeah. Yeah. And that phrase came from my heart, because yep. I couldn't hear it anymore. Because the funny thing was, when we introduced the 997 GT3, like a little throwback to the 997 era, everybody was complaining, why doesn't it have flappy pedals?
Yeah.
Why is it manual still? Ferrari has it and everybody has it. Now the GT3 should have that. And they were like a couple of years before, they were punishing us for not having a PDK or a flappy pedal gearbox, how they call it, in a GT3. And a couple of years later, everybody's complaining that the manual's gone. So kind of strange how things develop. No, but 991 GT3 first gen was a challenging project, because always when there's a new platform, like now in the 992 as well, there's a lot more to do for the engineering team. You need longer times. You have to, you're not basing on a first generation, and to be able to make a good evolution for the second generation, which is worth changing cars for. This is always important, because people expect something, some progress, some step ahead. Otherwise, they wouldn't step into the new car, so it wouldn't sell. But the 991 was always, when we did the RS 4-liter, there was this feeling in me: look at this 991 platform. And my electric guys came over. Hey, if you looked at 991, there's, I don't know, 55 black boxes in it. Nowadays we have like 7.
Yeah.
And this is going to be a super hard project for us. So. And we really were afraid of this new platform, because there were so many changes going alongside with that that we had to, that would take over, because we have to rely on the stuff that comes from a standard development. And it was a huge project, because it was a new platform for the car, and we needed a new engine. And you shouldn't do that together.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
should alternate that. And the engine was, as a matter of fact, everybody always says the big not the big problem, but it was the big challenge. It was a hugely capable engine. We've seen it in the second generation now, and even the 3.8 liter. To be frank, I mean, we said it had 475 horsepower, but it had a lot more. They were all 490-ish, and actually they were on par with the 4-liter RS engine. Yeah. From the power output, but the torque was better, and it revved to 9,000.
I mean, that was the thing about that engine, and it kept revving from 8 to 9. Yeah, I first drove it, I couldn't believe this was a street engine, because the way it pulled over
it
the last
was
1,000.
Super emotional. We were so happy with that thing, but we had this problem that later led to the sad problems with three cars that burned, that the engine could erupt, I would say, and the bearings. We're not strong enough in some parts of the engine on some engines, so we had to correct that, which we did. And but the engine itself was a masterpiece.
Do you think that maybe in the future these cars could become quite valuable, because that engine is, I mean, I know you re-engineered the engine with 4 liters, but the performance of the engine is different between 8 and 9, or it's peak power 8.5, isn't it?
It's not the performance; it's the sound it makes.
The emotion.
There's this metallic sound. This is not. Which is not moving parts, actually. It's really the air, the combustion process that you hear, and it sounds very metallic.
I think they could become very sought after cars, because there's not that many of them.
No, and if you've got a good example of that thing, they're quick as hell. We ourselves have one in our garage that is 6,000 kilometers or something like that. It's like brand new. I love to drive it. It's a great car. But it was not only the engine that was new. I mean, the whole chassis, for the first time, a PDK gearbox, rear axle steer. We threw so much technology to the car.
You had every single complication under the sun.
It was so complicated. And
did the team grow? Did you need to have a much bigger team around you to get through all this stuff? Or did you try and do it?
At least double as many people.
Was it?
Yeah, definitely. So it got a lot more complicated on the electrical side as well. And so we really had to reform and reorganize for the 981. Definitely, it was a huge undertaking.
So the first event where this thing was revealed, and I have spoken about this publicly, but not in this context, and we won't go into it for too long, was Andreas very kindly invited about three or four of us to go and meet him in Spain.
Oh, that story. Oh,
yeah, Jesus. Okay. We'll get through it quite quickly. Whoa. But let's just say that it was supposed to be, I think, the best press event that I'd ever go on. It was dreamy, quiet roads in northern Spain. It was just three or four people and Andreas and the new and three or four new 991 GT3s and an old 997 3.8 RS for us. Or was it a normal? Actually, it was a normal GT3, wasn't it?
It was a 997 Gen 2.
Gen 2.
Yeah.
It's a red one, wasn't it?
Red one,
And we could compare. And it was amazing getting into the new car and then getting into the old car and just feeling how lazy the front of the old car was. You couldn't make it turn, all the traditional problems. And the day, what it ended up with, police helicopters, me being frisked and searched for SIM cards by a person with a machine gun.
Several machine guns.
It was proper scary. The Spanish police didn't appreciate the fact there were lots of Porsches being driven. We weren't going that fast, but they were being driven at speed. And they made it very clear they wanted us to go. But as events go, that was one to remember. That really was one to remember. I remember hiding in a sort of Pyrenees ski resort with you.
Yeah.
We trying to hide these two cars. It was a bit like the Italian job. And someone phoning you going, the police are here. They know you're around there somewhere. They won't let us go until you come back. And you were going, shit, we've got to go. We've got to go. I'm going, no, we're not. We can just stay here. And you went, how fucking long can we stay here? We can't stay here forever.
And I was the only one being able to speak Spanish. So I thought I could contribute something to the situation. And when we came around the corner and all this policemen with the machine guns hanging around, I mean, in the middle of nowhere. I mean, this is, it's close to Andorra. And there's a lot of frontier police or whatever you might call it, and so they were pretty quick reacting to our
do you go back to Spain very often to drive like that?
Since then, never. So that made us really, I mean, we lost our favorite proving grounds there, because it was infested with police since then, and we compromised the whole area, so we had to look for new roads, and which we found, I'm really happy now that we searched, because we found something better. Where we are now, I don't want to give away where it is.
Yeah, don't take me there either.
But it's better, and it's in a country where people love cars, and that helps.
Yeah. So we've gone through this period where you've had to sort the engines out on the car, but the crazy thing is that I don't think any other sporting sub-brand of a car maker could have survived the way that GT3 did, because actually it didn't actually diminish the way people wanted the cars. They still wanted the cars. More people wanted the cars. So you've got through that episode, you've re-engineered the engine in a way that is so rigorous. I remember saying to you, could this happen again? You went, no, this couldn't happen again. This is what we have done with this engine now. It is bulletproof. And it hasn't. The thing is bulletproof, isn't it? And then the RS comes out and everyone just goes crazy and almost forgets there's ever been a problem.
Yep.
So for you, that must have been personally a great moment, because then the monkey's off your back, isn't it? You're back on thinking about the future.
It was hard times for me as a employee, as a manager, as the people, the anchor man of the GT series. So I was to blame for everybody. And maybe it was that way. I signed it off, but nothing happened. Nothing ever happened in development like that. And the company stood together very well. Wolfgang Hatz was our boss back then in Weissach, a guy I adore still. He's such a great guy, and he always was protecting us. We were one team, and that was very, very good to have help from all sides. And finally, I think we addressed the issue right with the customer, because we went to the customer and said, okay, we made a mistake here. Well, we'll help you get new engines. And everybody was really appreciating our authenticity and our openness to talk about that and to react that quick and satisfying for the customer. And so this car will hold its value as all the others, because if something happens to the engine, we made this promise to take care of it.
So the RS comes along. One of the best days of my life is when you managed to get you managed to get us Weissach for a couple of hours.
And
you turned up with all the colours. That was a good day out. That car was special because it looked so outrageous on the street with the big 21-inch rear wheel and the big wings. That was when the value proposition of the RS brand and GT3 just went crazy because people were buying them so sure they were going to go up in value that maybe that was the beginning of the good times and the bad times because people were buying them for the wrong reasons.
I think the GT3 RS 981 was maybe one of the GT3s with the most want one factor. That's right. Especially the purple one. I mean, you were the first journalist that was allowed to drive that car on the Porsche proving ground using a drone for filming.
Do you remember that? That was something completely new to get the clearance for the drone, the paperwork.
Wolfgang Hals liked you, definitely. Yeah, that helped. And it was great footage. I still look at it from time to time. The sad thing is all the purple cars were crashed, so we don't have one single purple car left.
You're not?
Yeah, really. Yeah. The press purple car was damaged or crashed in the Nürburgring. Mr. Purple, that one, almost at the same spot a couple of days later. So there was some bad karma around this color.
Would you ever make another purple car?
Not for us. There might be some customer cars out there. It was a very rare color, I think. And I think from the price of the aftermarket price or the used car prices of the purple car is still higher than on any other color.
Is it?
I think so, yeah, because it's rare. And it was people shied away from it first, and then everybody loved it. But then it was too late. Then the cars were already sold. That was a great car. Still, I have a white one, a completely innocent looking white one with silver wheels, Gen 1, and I'm still driving it from time to time. It's very good to drive the old cars. We're talking about the RS 4-liter. That it was a great car. The other day, I just got the keys and did some laps and took it home, and it was last summer, and this car is still very, very good and teaches us something. And normally you tend to glorify things over the past. You have to readjust and really drive them from time to time to know where you're at, where you're standing at the moment. And the RS 4-liter still is in some virtues or in some issues, it's really still benchmark.
Around that time, you've been getting some pressure from probably your customers, a little bit of pressure from the media. Why don't you do a manual gearbox car? Are you ever going to do a manual gearbox car? And you and whoever's around at that time, Mr. Hatz, maybe he's still around at that time, is saying, no, we don't need one. We're fine. Mm. And then one day we hear rumor there's going to be a manual car. It's not going to be called a GT car, but it might have no wings. And he might call it a 911R. And of course, people like me just went absolutely apeshit because it's the car I had always wanted. How difficult was it to get the board to agree to make that car?
Let me think. It was quite difficult, yeah. we had the idea of making this super low-key looking driver's car with all the GT technology in it. And we had something similar in our heritage, the 911R, which I always found a very attractive car from the idea, all this lightweight stuff. And I knew exactly there was such a big market for that. But because we lost some customers, some driver's car customers, because in the earlier times we could address driver's cars and track aficionados, the track was with the same car.
Yeah.
Because you have the manual gearbox, take all the weight out you can, you got a fast car and you got a driver's car. But with the 991, that changed. And so we left some people behind, not having any offering anymore for the people that really wanted the aura of a GT car, not especially going to the track at the weekends. And so the 911R idea came along, and I built up a car based on a normal Carrera, and nobody knew it. I did that car and the open version, the Speedster, at the same time. And just for the heck of it, because I found out it's a lot easier to impress people with hardware than with PowerPoint. And this is definitely came true in that case. And we were playing around with colors and with parts from the RS, inventing new colors like single mass flywheel and all that. Everybody knows the tech specs, I think, of the 911R. And so we had the first car that really was drivable. It was so much fun. It was so good. And we dared to present it to the board and rather unprepared. So it was like a shooting star coming along. So nobody saw it coming. And that was the mistake. Normally you have to prepare and talk, get people the chance to understand the idea. And all of a sudden there was some call coming from the board member meeting and that day, oh, bring up the 9/11R. Hartmut Christen called me. And we have some time left and maybe it was a good chance to just show it to them. And I went like, maybe not the best idea, but okay, boss is calling, so let's do it. And it ran in the wrong direction because nobody was prepared for the car. It wasn't explained properly because we didn't have the time to do it. So there was just this white car with the green stripes and the Porsche lettering and us explaining a little bit what the reason behind that car is. And we saw some eyebrows going up. And
you know when you've lost the room, don't you?
Yeah. And they didn't understand the purpose of the car first. But it was maybe the bad presentation. We were not prepared. Don't want to blame anybody. In the couple of weeks after that, when we did the political work around it, the tide changed and everybody said, okay, come on, let's do it. Yeah. But the first approach was completely thing for the coffin.
What of all the cars, take into account GT3 Touring and where we are at now with 992, of all of the cars that you've made, which do you think was the one that people wanted the most, that people were most willing to use or deploy the power they had to get one, whether it was a member of the Piëch family or a journalist from the UK or people that knew you? Which gave you the sense that that was the one they were willing to use their ace card to get one? I always felt it was the 911R of all of them.
Yeah.
Do you think it was?
You might be right. I would without thinking too much, I would say shooting from the hip, that was the 911R, yeah.
Because, I mean, then how many did you make in the end?
900 and something.
91?
991, yeah.
And you could have made, if you...
I don't know. This is I couldn't prove that, but I think we could have sold easily 3,000 of those, if not more.
Amazing. And then came the new engine, the 4-liter, I call it the MF. It really is a great engine. Revs to 9 has not quite the aggression of the very first 9A1 GT3 car, but it's not far off. Between 8 and 9, it's still incredible. And
it has more power there. It's just the acoustics that are different. So
the lighter internals mean it feels like it has a lightweight flywheel.
A lot less internal resistance. I mean, this second gen engine is, if you look at it closely, it's a new engine.
And that is the basis of the GT3 going forward, isn't it?
Because
the 992 is not that dissimilar, is it?
I really have to say I'm absolutely 100% convinced that this engine is more bulletproof than the Metzger ever was.
That's a statement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that at that level of power and specific power, I mean, we're doing like 125 horsepower per liter. If we're talking about the Metzger engine, depending on which engine we are talking about, if it's the 996, 997, or the later versions, they all were a lot lower on power and on internal stress than the new one.
I don't want to talk too much about the 992 GT3 because I think the car is still new. It's been incredibly well received. It's just built. It's built on the legacy again. Everyone wants one. The prices, certainly in the UK, are through the roof. It proves once again that if you want a car that drives a certain way, and you want to do some track driving and some road driving, there still is no substitute. The GT3 is still the car. But if I said to you now, so you have 5 years left, 10 years left to work in the automotive industry, and you could make a sports car, maybe a Porsche, and you have good resources to make it, what would you? And it's got to be an exciting street car that maybe takes performance driving in a different direction. What car would you like to make? Would you like to make a smaller, lighter car? Would you want to make a street car? I have this dream of a 850 kilogram carbon fiber bodied. Is that possible? What would you do?
I mean, it's if it totally unhinged and do everything from scratch and you don't have to live with the platform, I think a smaller Carrera GT car, like a 1200 kilo max, 450 horsepower car would be the sweet spot for me to have the ultimate fun on the road. I didn't want to I wouldn't want too big of a footprint.
Yeah,
cars tend to get bigger, bigger, and bigger. And the intimacy of a cabin of a sports car is great. I mean, if you drive the 993, your shoulders are almost touching. And then if you go in the 992, you need almost binoculars to see the co-driver. No, I'm exaggerating, but I think a sports car in a way that Porsche started its brand
904 GTS style car,
a two-seater, open, lightweight, normally aspirated engine, not too big power, because big power means big brakes, big everything means weight. Find that exact sweet spot of about 1100 kilo-ish, something like that. Beautiful shape, to a feast from every angle, and with a great sound. That would be something I would like to own myself.
Okay, I'm like everyone else listening to this. I'm bought into it. Can you go and make it, please? Well, can you go and make this car, please?
I can talk to the persons responsible. And, we got a lot of idea, and there's there's some products coming in the near future that are really keeping us busy. But I think it's very important to keep the core of the brand alive, which is sport cars, pureness, purity, and performance. Without too much gizmos around you that distract you from driving, this is something I think that will hold value ever and ever, because it's made for the sake of driving,
yeah,
and a hobby tool.
So I'm going to ask you one last question before we wrap up, because I've got to get on a plane. This is the last question. One of the reasons why we've always got on reasonably well is I don't ask you about stuff about the future. I'm never trying to sell news stories about what the next Porsche is, because that's almost don't want to spoil the surprise. I'd like to find out the way everyone else does.
Yeah.
But I think all of us that love GT3s and love just performance cars on the road are worried about what the future holds. So you, as the director of GT cars, you have a very, very educated view on what you think is possible for the future and what's not. Do you think that in 3 years' time, Porsche will still be able to sell you a GT-branded car that is high performance and has, and is the type of car we all want to drive? Is it 3-4 years' time? Will we still be doing that?
I think I like to think positively.
Yeah.
We have different boundary conditions regarding regulations worldwide. So as it stands right now for the US, I would say clearly yes. Yeah. In Europe, what ideas come out of Brussels these days are really alarming for the combustion engine in general, and for the high performance, high revving, emotional combustion engine all the more. I wouldn't say 3 years, but if this new emission regulation EU7 will be put into effect, which means registering a car is possible till mid-26, something like that, till that point in time, the next 5 years almost, I have high hopes that with technology and with motivation from all sides, we can continue the route that we're going at the moment. It's going to be more complicated, but we'll find ways, because there's a lot of good and clever people all around me. It's not only myself, it's a team. I think I'm not too worried about that. After 26, we have to see what the regulations really bring, because it's not 100% sure that they will put into effect by then. It's still in a discussion, but it will get harder and harder from the noise regulations as well. And noise is a very, very important selling point or characteristic point of a GT car. So it's going to be challenging, but I have high hopes that for the next 3 years, that was your question, we'll be fine.
End on a positive note. It's been a pleasure talking to you. There's some great stuff in there for anyone that loves Porsche GT cars. Andreas Preuninger, enjoy your weekend.
Thank you. I need it.
Collecting Cars, the global online marketplace devoted to cars, bikes, and automobilia. A safe, smart, and simple auction experience for everyone. List for free. sell for free, hassle free. Follow us on Instagram at Collecting Cars and also collectingcars.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.